No, it's all right. I just have to do track breaks.
John is by far the easiest Greek in the New Testament. You can read it right off the page. It's very fluent, very, very good Koine Greek. Some of the most difficult Greek in the New Testament, syntax is atrocious, is Revelation and some of Peter's letters, parts of Peter's letters. If Peter wrote them, Peter wasn't real good at Greek.
Well, it stands to reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But John's is the most fluent and the easiest.
Well, that would serve my theory well, that it's not John's hand. All right. When do these things happen? Most New Testament scholars would place the Synoptic Gospels late in the first century, like in the 70s. 80s, 90s, all right, and that's possible. And they would place John in the beginning of the second century. I would move those back a little bit. I would say that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are pre-destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Because they don't mention it, and it would be. If you were writing that after the destruction of Jerusalem, when you got to those apocalyptic narratives where the master was telling what was going to happen and how it was going to go down, you'd sort that out. And you wouldn't be able to resist saying, and this came to pass exactly as he had said. So, I would argue that they're pre-70. And that stands to reason. If the story about Mark is true, Mark would have to be written before Peter died, and Peter died in 65, I think. 65 Common Era.
How did all what you're saying makes perfect sense? How did all of these New Testament scholars miss what seems to be a very obvious?
Oh, they argue about it. They would say, in regard to that point, they would say, no, this is it's an attempt. It's actually an attempt to make it look prophetic, you know. So,
well, they do the same thing with Daniel.
Yeah, they do the same thing with the Old Testament prophets. To which I would reply again, you know, if you were going to do that, you'd do a lot better job.
That implies a pretty distinct bias on the part of these alleged.
They're critical scholars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just critical scholars start from the assumption of zero, that it's not true. And so that's something that people oftentimes don't understand when they read critical scholarship, is that critical scholarship has a bias. It's not unbiased. It intentionally has a bias, and the bias is to overcompensate on the side of criticism. That's why it's called criticism. And by overcompensating with criticism, hopefully you get to you're able to cut through a lot of assumptions. And this is not just the approach to the Bible. Critical scholarship, that's how it works across the board. We would do the same thing to Greek literature. We'd do the same thing to something that's allegedly written by Plato. We'll do the same thing to something that's allegedly written by Homer. That's Shakespeare. It's a methodology. But people don't understand that, and so they take the conclusions of critical scholarship, which should be understood to be way, like, this is as low as you can go. And they understand that as like, oh, well, that's what it is then.
And they also take their conclusions, and a lot of times their conclusions are more scholarly than religious.
Yeah, they're not faith-based. They're not people of faith whatsoever. And unfortunately, a lot of what passes for critical scholarship, for good critical scholarship, is not good critical scholarship. Unfortunately, the field is just as full of goofballs as any other field. You know, I mean, you know, every one of you who has a career knows that there's people in your career field who are legitimate and people who are goofballs. And the average person can't tell the difference. But you can, because you're in the field. Well, it's the same It's the same in biblical criticism.
So is it accurate to say that these conclusions have really no basis in fact, that they really are just speculation and theory? If you're beginning mm-hmm. with an assumption that can't be proven, mm-hmm. that you're starting out from a negative place, and it is by definition illogical.
I would not say that. I would not go that far to say they have no basis in fact, because a critical scholar will present you with his evidence. As you read, he'll say, this is why I think this, and this is what I see. You know, this is, I see this here, and that indicates such and such. But then some other scholar will come along and say, you're wrong about that. This is where you made a mistake. You know, so it's like an ongoing dialogue that never ends.
You were talking last week about the fellow that wrote the stuff that was a lot like the author of the Da Vinci Code. I don't remember the fellow's name.
Dan Brown.
Pulling the stuff out.
Right.
I mean, you were talking but you were talking about this other guy that used that same,
yep.
I call it, methodology.
Yes.
Pulling stuff out, explaining why he thought that. I mean, mm-hmm. it sort of sounds like an attempt at critical scholarship.
That is, that's an excellent example. He's referring to Chaim Jacoby's book. That's an excellent example of junk scholarship, mm-hmm. is what it's called in the academic community. Junk scholarship in the cloak of critical scholarship. So it pretends to be, you know, this legitimate stuff, but it's really just wild-eyed theories. Okay. Enough of that.
Did you have a turn?
Yeah, I just did a track break, yeah. John is, you, David asked, what about John? So I'm, you know, and you don't have to take my word for it. You can say whenever you want, as long as you keep the synoptics in the first century. But some scholars would put them in the early second century. But
using the logic, the only reason I said that was because using the logic that you said that, because he never mentions the temple destruction either.
Right.
So if that's the logic to put the first three, then why wouldn't you put that one there?
Because John does not mention the material about the master's prophecies about the destruction of Jerusalem either. So that's not even but I would, here's why I would put John, here's one verse that I would go with for a post destruction. There's a passage in John where he's describing Gethsemane, and he says there used to be a garden there, and there's not anymore. You know, the implication being the garden is gone. Well, we know that the Romans denuded Mount of Olives in building siege works and crosses to crucify Jews on during the siege. So John says there used to be a garden there. So I would take that as perhaps an indication that it's after the destruction of Jerusalem. There's other clues in John that tell us that it's late. There's the, what's the word? Antipathy? Yeah. The antipathy, the strong
I don't like you
feelings between the Johannine community and the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. That comes through very clearly in John. So that tells you that there's enough time has passed where there's an identity that has formed that's separate, that now sees itself as separate from greater Judaism around it. And so if we look at the historical data, what could have caused that? Well, for one thing, around the year 90, Common Era, the believers were thrown out of the synagogue. And we have the introduction of the blessing against heretics. And so we know that under the Sanhedrin at Yavne of Rabbi Gamliel ben Shimon. I always get those mixed up. Under Gamliel ben Shimon, that the believers are excommunicated. So this is the reason you find that kind of polemical edge all the time in John. But the Jews said this, and the Jews did that, and it. You don't find that in the Synoptics. In the Synoptics, we're all Jews still. You know, in John, it's like the Jews versus us. So that's another indication that John is late. So how late? We don't really know. But I would guess no earlier than 90. No earlier than 90, Common Era.
When did John die?
No, that was that's Peter. John died around the end of the first century. Somewhere between, he lived into Trajan's time, it says in the Church Fathers. And so that would have him dying in the last decade of the first century, I think. He was really old. He was 100 years old, or something like that.
That was always taught like 95 to 180,
something. Yeah, somewhere in there. Okay, so those are the Gospels, and that's why when we read the epistles, it doesn't seem like they are reading the Gospels, because the Gospels aren't written yet. Good enough. Okay, second century Gospels do not present a credible picture. When he says second century Gospels, he means all of them, because he's going with the most liberal of the critical scholarship, which places them all in the second century. All right. So he says, here's the problem. Even if you take these Gospels, you've got John over here, and you've got the Synoptics over here, and the Synoptics kind of agree on stuff, but then there's discrepancies with John. For example, he gives us the Passover discrepancy. What's the Passover discrepancy? Oy. It's a real problem. John gives us a chronology of the Passion Week according to one, this day one, day two, day three sort of thing, and the Synoptics give us a totally different. So in John, the Last Supper actually happens the day before Passover. So it's not a Passover Seder per se. Whereas in the Synoptics, it's the day of Passover had come. And so it's definitely a Passover Seder. So you have, that's probably the biggest discrepancy chronologically. But there's a couple others between John and the Gospels. There's various ways to reconcile these, and we could do that. We could create a couple pages of Gemara and argue about it and come up with a couple different theories. And I've done that now and then at different points. But I'm happiest when I just say, this is a difficulty. Because I don't like to rob the credibility of John, and I don't like to rob the credibility of the Synoptics. I like to preserve them both and admit, yes, this is a difficulty. Rabbi Lichtenstein has a nice reconciliation. I can't remember it. He does a nice reconciliation. Everybody does. Everybody takes a swing at it. You know? Okay. What else? So he says, and here's another one. In the Synoptics, everybody agrees how the disciples are called. Jesus walking along the beaches of Capernaum. He says, Peter, come follow me. John, come follow me. They leave their nets. They come follow him. John tells a totally different story. In John, it's two disciples of John the Baptist. Andrew and an unidentified disciple follow Jesus. Andrew goes and gets Peter. It's a totally different story. Then they go and they turn water to wine. Then they go up to Passover together. You know, and all of this and happens, right? It's a totally different story. Completely different. It really is. So how do you, what do you do with that? Well, they're not actually competing narratives. They're only competing if you assume that the first time that when Yeshua walked up to Peter and he said, come follow me, Peter had never seen this guy in his life before, didn't know who he was, and dropped his nets and followed him in a zombie-like trance. You know, and I think that's the way that we generally think of it, but that's definitely not the story. John tells us the story that happened before the arrest of John the Baptist. The Synoptic Gospels begin their narratives with the disciples after the arrest of John the Baptist. And that's the difference. John gives us the backstory of how he knew these guys in the first place and why it was that they were willing to give up everything and follow him in the first place. The prequel. All right, what else does he say? Mark is the source for Luke and Matthew. Right. We've already covered that. John has no infancy narratives. That's true. Neither does Mark, by the way. So.
What does that mean?
Nothing. So he says, most New Testament scholars believe the Gospels existed in some form in the late first century. Wow! Did you see that? That's what he said. Most New Testament scholars believe the Gospels existed in some form in the late first century. However, he says, this seems highly unlikely since the epistles never refer to them. Conclusion, unknown individuals who were not disciples, apostles, or witnesses to the events described wrote the Gospels. There you go. All right. The Christian Bible has been altered and corrected. Okay, now we move into another field of attack. Let's say that we have the whole thing. We have the New Testament, and it's all in these Greek documents, and we've got one copy. All right, we've got one copy, and so now we want to start disseminating it. It never happened so cleanly as this, of course. Instead, I mean, let's be reasonable. At what point did someone say, well, here it is, I just finished the New Testament. Let's start copying this and sending this out to the churches. How did this happen for real? Have you ever thought about this? How did we get this New Testament? Well, you've got, yeah, I mean, it's the actual, like, what books are legitimate wasn't determined for several hundred years. What you had was every church in every place, every community of believers had their precious books. They had their scrolls and their precious books. And they would copy these and send them to buddies and to exchange them. They would borrow them. They'd be, oh, we promise we'll bring it back to you, you know, right after Passover. You know, and then they would read them aloud. They would read them aloud when they would assemble, because 99% of the people were not literate. So the person who, like, you had someone in your congregation who could read, that was great. And so the reader would read, and he would read them aloud. Everybody listens. And then you pass these around. And eventually, the church, as it develops ecclesiastical authority, it says, you know, some places are reading some really weird stuff. There is some really, really wacko weird stuff being read out there, and it's causing problems. We need to figure out what goes back to the first generation. And so what they did was they looked at the consensus of writers, ancient writers, early writers, and what they cited as the epistles and gospels that they had that were the authentic apostolic voice. So to be authentic and to make the final cut, you had to, number one, be part of the apostolic community. You were either an apostle or a disciple of an apostle. All right? And number two, it had to be part of that first century era, which I guess is the same as number one in terms of human lifespan. Yes?
I was reading about that just this week.
Okay.
One of my questions was, the people that were making this decision here, mm-hmm. based on these writings back here, could they have had a bias about what it was that they were accepting based on
yes.
where they thought that they
yes.
were coming from?
Yes, and that's often brought up, is that they did have a bias, and they threw out things that should not have been thrown out. But the thing is, we have most of what they threw out. It's still extant, most of it. Unfortunately, the ones that are not still extant are the Jewish Gospels. Those we only have in fragments, the ones from Hebrew and that sort of thing. That would be what would be nice to have. But in terms of the Greek texts, you don't want any of that. The stuff they threw out, they made good decisions. They made very good decisions. And how do we know? How can you tell? Just read it. You read it, you'll say, that was a good thing to throw that out. It's so not Jewish. The stuff they threw out is so not Jewish that it smells. You know, it smells phony. as you're reading it, you there's no question. This is phony. I mean, if you're familiar with the authentic, it's like if you know a good cigar, you know when you've got a bad one. You know?
When you say that there was a lot of bad teaching being put around, are you talking about Martian?
Yeah, I'm talking about Gnosticism. I'm talking about the Gnostic Gospels, and not only the Gnostic stuff. There's different stuff that's kind of just is strange. I enjoy that material, and I enjoy reading it and trying to figure out who thought of this and what were they trying to accomplish and that sort of thing. But it's not just that. There's also what you could call Orthodox Christians that are fabricating material, like fabricating Pauline letters and that sort of thing in order to advance their agendas, or because they're just they'd like more of the story, you know. It's like they want a sequel, you know. So you do see a lot of that. You see all those apocryphal Acts of the Apostles, where the apostles are doing all sorts of tremendous miracles. It's entertainment. It was first or second, third century entertainment.
There was a statement